Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we will be talking with Dr. Judith Tintinnalli, Professor and Chair Emeritus of Emergency Medicine, about life and death in the ER.
This is a light topic, Christy.
I know. It is a heavy topic, but an important one.
Everyone's familiar with it.
Everyone knows.
Everyone has experience.
How important the emergency department can be. And she certainly will have a lot to share as a very experienced emergency physician, a leader in her field about emergency medicine.
But first, Christy, we've got some research that matters about Alzheimer's disease and stress,
about acupuncture and depression,
about how difficult or not is breastfeeding among newborn mothers.
And or about mothers with newborns.
Yes.
And about herbal products containing too many unlisted ingredients.
Well, let's talk about our very first research that matters, Christy, about Alzheimer's disease and stress. And I don't think we've ever really talked about this sort of research before, because we know Alzheimer's disease is incredibly common in the United States and worldwide, and stress is very common in the United States and worldwide. So are the two related?
And this study is about middle-aged women, and I have to admit, Adam, when I read this, I felt a little stressed because it is.
Well, you're not middle-aged yet, but you're not too far.
According to this study, I am. They looked at middle-aged women. This was a large study of Swedish women that started back in the 1960s with participants who were at least 38 years old. They followed them and surveyed them every decade about their mental health and well-being and about their overall health.
Yeah, they had 800 women, and they, within the period of time they looked at it, or by 2005, 153 had developed dementia, including 104 with Alzheimer's disease. And the question that they found is that when these women talked about how much stress they had in their lives, the stress was actually related to the development of this Alzheimer's disease.
It was. This was a study that was published in British Medical Journal Open, and they found that for each additional stressor women reported back in the 60s, their risk of later developing Alzheimer's disease increased by about 20%.
And this long-term distress was related to this heightened risk, even if they didn't have specific stressful events. So if they just had kind of chronic stress. And well, one thing, Christy, you're not Swedish, so.
Well, thank you. That makes me feel so much better.
So much better. The stress won't apply to you. No, I think this is a take-home lesson really for all of us, which is that we're trying to look for this genetic link for Alzheimer's. We're looking for some environmental link, but some of the links might be right underneath us, which is this chronic stress could be related. This is not cause and effect, but certainly it's worrisome.
That's exactly the point I would make. It's not cause and effect, but it's another clue and another thing to tell us to slow down, exercise, and work on reducing stress in our lives.
Smell the roses. Well, let's talk about our very next research that matters, which deals with, again, two common things that people have experienced. One is acupuncture, which people increasingly have tried or used for some condition, and the other is depression. And the question is, does acupuncture a legitimate treatment for depression?
Yeah, and the bottom line here is that acupuncture was as good as counseling for depression. They looked in this study at 755 people who had moderate or severe depression, split them into groups to get acupuncture for 12 weeks, or counseling sessions, or usual care only.
And what was really interesting is that all of the groups actually got better. And they measured this on a scale, depression scale, that improved whether they had acupuncture, whether they had the counseling, or whether they got the usual care session. And so it wasn't like one was actually better than the other, but it is of interest that the folks who got acupuncture got better as much as those who had the weekly counseling.
Yeah, about 30 to 33% of patients were no longer depressed after 3 months of acupuncture or counseling, but more like 20% were better after usual treatment, not being counseling.
They didn't get either of these particular treatments, which suggests that some people get better actually with very little
right.
care. But yet there was a pretty good improvement, not like it was universal, with the acupuncture or with the counseling. So based upon this, would you recommend that people who are depressed, who maybe don't want to get counseling or can't access counseling, they consider acupuncture?
Absolutely. I think cost is a factor. Some insurances won't cover it. But if one can figure out a way to pay for the acupuncture, it's safe. There's not a lot of downside or harm to it, and it might just help.
I don't think either of us see a big drawback there, but our next research that matters is something that we might also agree upon, and this is the concerns that many women have who are having babies. Now, they're not newborn mothers themselves, but they do have newborns and their mothers, about how difficult it is for many of them to continue to breastfeed, even when they plan on it.
Yeah, so we know that the World Health Organization and pretty much every group out there recommends exclusive breastfeeding. And the American Academy of Pediatricians, we all know that breastfeeding is very good for babies. And moms often plan to do this and want to do this. But they looked in this new study after realizing that very few women make it to 6 months even exclusively breastfeeding. And so they surveyed first-time mothers-to-be to find out what their plans were, what their concerns were after birth, and then how long they breastfed.
Yeah, and what was really interesting about this study, Christy, that was published in the journal Pediatrics, is they interviewed these mothers 6 times within the first 2 months, and these women raised lots of individual concerns about breastfeeding, a total of 49 different concerns. And I was a little surprised at the number of concerns, but also how many of the mothers, between 20 and 50%, stopped breastfeeding sooner than they had planned to do or added formula. And even those that were partially breastfed, a lot of those stopped early, which tells me that this is common and it's difficult, and we need to really understand it and provide support like we do in family medicine.
Well, and they discovered that 92% of the mothers at 3 days after birth were worried about breastfeeding and had specific concerns. And those mothers who were more concerned were 3 times more likely to give up breastfeeding earlier in the course. So suggesting that we still have a lot of work to do, as we put a lot of emphasis on in family medicine, in supporting breastfeeding, supporting new moms, supporting families through that very challenging time.
And we really have a 3-day window to really get it right, because by 3 days out, a lot of people have kind of started making decisions. And so meeting with that lactation consultant before delivery and meeting with them right after delivery and meeting with them every day for 3 days, that's the model we're going to probably have to do to help women who would like to breastfeed, which we all support.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about our very last research that matters, Christy, about herbal products and maybe unknown things that are in them.
Okay, striking. I don't know if this is surprising to people or not, but when you take herbal products that are over the counter, as we've pointed out, Adam, they're not controlled by the Federal Drug Administration. So there's not as much information about what's in them. So this was a study that tested 44 different herbal products sold by 12 different companies to find out what products are in there that might not be listed.
Yeah, and over 60% of these products contained things that weren't listed on the label. So, for instance, 20% had things like rice and soybeans and wheat, which is a problem for people who have allergies to these sorts of things. And others had kind of things you wouldn't expect in it. For instance, St. John's wort had senna, which is a laxative. You wouldn't expect that if you took St. John's wort for depression, to know that you're going to maybe potentially go and have diarrhea or loose stools.
I think this really just highlights that when you're taking these products, you don't know what you're taking. And so you do want to be cautious and careful. And if you're having other symptoms, it might be because of something that's mixed into that product that you're not aware of.
A much healthier skepticism than maybe a lot of people have. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters, Christy. We've had a good chance to talk about healthy skepticism in herbal products.
We've talked about breastfeeding concerns that are common among new mothers.
About acupuncture can be potentially as good as counseling for mild depression.
And that midlife stress might be linked to Alzheimer's.
We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking to Dr. Judith Tintinelli about life and death in the emergency room. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Judith Tintinelli, Professor and Chair Emeritus of Emergency Medicine at the University of North Carolina, about life and death in the emergency room, a looking back and at the present and at the future of emergency medicine.
Welcome, Dr. Tintinelli. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, you've had a remarkable career to date. I know you've been involved in the major textbook of emergency medicine and now in a new documentary called 24/7/365. Give us a little picture about your journey and what has led you to be so passionate about emergency medicine.
Well, I can tell you a little bit about the documentary first, if I may, because that was an initiative by the Emergency Medicine Residents Association. And a group of residents that are pretty much now just finished their program or in the final years of the program were trying to find out about the history of the specialty. And they were afraid, as many as the first leaders aged, that they wouldn't be able to get any first-hand information about the history of the specialty. So they did fundraising about 2 years ago, just by direct contributions from emergency physicians around the United States, and then were able to get funding to put together the video. The video actually interviewed many of the very first generation of emergency physicians, and I don't consider myself the first generation. I consider myself the second generation because I was mentored by those who were there to start off the specialty. So I started my career in Detroit at Detroit Receiving Hospital. And of course, you say the word Detroit and it conjures up images of, you know, gunshots, stabs, all kinds of violence. And that's exactly how it was. And it was a very interesting place. And it was a great place to really get hooked onto emergency medicine. So as a medical student, everybody who wanted to do anything would just go down to the ER and do suturing or help in resuscitations, help treat gunshots and stabs. And I think that's really how it started. It's interesting because at the beginning.
Dr. Tintinelli, I was just going to ask you, you know, I'm reflecting back to when I was an intern and the discipline of emergency medicine is because it's still such a young specialty, you know, 30 years ago, it didn't exist. And at that time, even the emergency room was staffed by cardiology fellows and sometimes interns with very little experience. And so the stabs and the gunshots and the knives and all that's not new. At some point in time, someone had to decide it's not too wise to have our emergency rooms that were all the serious traumas coming in staffed by people who don't necessarily have the most experience.
Well, and you're right. And the idea of emergency medicine actually started simultaneously in two small family practice groups, one in Pontiac, Michigan, and the other in Arlington, Virginia. And it was these two independent family practice groups that just realized that emergency medical care was just not what patients deserved. And they took their practices and reorganized them so they worked 24/7 in the emergency departments. And that idea spread like wildfire, and that was in the early 70s. And from then on, the number of people who just liked the emergency department, the number of people grew, and the number of people who wanted to work there and devote all their time to there and learn what they had to learn, that number grew. And out of that evolved emergency medicine residencies. But I should tell you about the very first residency and the very first resident. And he's a good friend of mine. Bruce Janiak is his name. He's still working in Augusta, Georgia.
And that's where I trained.
Well, he was a myth. That's where you trained?
Absolutely. In Augusta, Georgia. Yes. Oh. I'm very familiar.
Well, that's where Bruce is now. But he was a medical student at Cincinnati. And as a moonlighting job, he took on a job at a rural Kentucky hospital where his job was running the ER. He was a medical student, and that's how they staffed ERs in rural Kentucky at that time. And not only was he responsible for the ER, he also had to handle all the emergencies in-house in that hospital. So he realized there was a lot to learn, and he went to the dean at the University of Cincinnati, told him what he wanted to do, and asked if he could become a resident, plot out his own path, and report solely to the dean. The dean agreed to that, and out of that, after Bruce, more people started getting interested in emergency medicine. More people signed up for what Bruce had organized, and it became a section responsible only to the dean at Cincinnati. And then, you know, after a few years went by, not really long, but a few years, it became its own department. So isn't that a great beginning story?
It is. It is what courage and bravery and what an example of adult learning. You know, in the documentary, it states that emergency medicine was once referred to as the pit. Why was it the pit? Well, I can think of lots of reasons, but I'd love to hear from your perspective. Why was it called the pit, and how has that transformed over the last 50 years?
Well, you know, when you say the word pit, what do you think about? Oh, my gosh, you think about the bottom of the pit. ERs were always on the main floor or the bottom of the hospital. It was where everything fell to the bottom, so all the stuff came in there. You would have to sort it out, clear it out, get it out of the pit. I never really thought about that very much, but it's a pretty good description. Before we had the organized specialty, ERs were very disorganized, very chaotic. And as you said earlier, it's true, at a time when patients were most vulnerable, you had the people with the least experience working there to treat their disorders. And of course, in the 60s and early 70s, it wasn't a whole lot that you could do in terms of time-sensitive illness. We didn't have cardiac caths. We didn't have thrombolysis for stroke. But even then, I mean, we had CPR. You know, we had asthma to treat and anaphylaxis. And we did have heart attacks, only we couldn't do very much for them. So it was a good time for the specialty to start, because over the past 40 years or so, we've really had the development of a lot of time-sensitive therapies that need to be employed right at the beginning when people first come into the ED.
Well, I know we're gonna take a break in a minute, and I know we're gonna really want to talk about kind of, you know, what's the real challenges, and we know the excitement of those who want to go into emergency medicine, but the real challenges. And I know one of the challenges is that you have to figure out who's sick and who's not sick. Is that the first thing you really have to do, or not? And how do you do that? Because if they're really sick, you think about them differently, don't you?
Yes, and that's a good approach to how we work in the ED. And our practice is a bit different because, yes, when we see a patient with a particular complaint, we always start out with the idea, what is the worst thing this could be? What is the most life-threatening thing this could be? So, for example, if you have an older patient who comes to the ED with back pain or severe back pain, the one likely disorder or disease could be a kidney stone. Now, that is very painful, but it's not going to kill anybody. But when you're in emergency, you first think of, well, maybe this is a ruptured aortic aneurysm. An aortic aneurysm is a ballooning out of the aorta, and once the pressure gets too big, it just explodes. So that's sort of how we think. We think, okay, could this be the worst thing, the life-threatening thing? And then we work essentially going down the ladder till we have ruled out all the bad things.
Well, Dr. Tentinelli.
So it's a different way of practice.
It is a different way of practice, and we're looking forward to hearing more about the challenges you face and the way you're able to do that so quickly with so many patients at one time. We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, Adam and I will continue talking with our guest, Dr. Judith Tentinelli, about life and death in the ER. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Judith Tentinelli, Professor and Chair Emeritus of Emergency Medicine at the University of North Carolina, about life and death in the emergency room. And Dr. Tentinelli, before we took a break, you were telling us about, you know, some of the ways of thinking in emergency medicine of sick and not sick and ruling out the worst thing. Being married to an emergency physician myself, you know, I see some of the challenges of the humanity of it all. As you see all walks of life and a variety of situations in the emergency department, and a lot of very horrible and disturbing things as well. And I wonder how you balance over time, how you've balanced humanity and your emotions so that you can still carry on with life, with the shocking things that you see?
Well, you know, it used to be, my husband used to ask me every day, well, what did you see today in the ER that was, you know, really unusual and really different, any kind of, you know, strange cases? And he's noticed that over the years, my recounting of these cases, I have fewer and fewer cases to talk about. So part of it is you get used to such extraordinary things that happen on an everyday basis that some things will actually, you know, lose their impact. Now, there are always very, very sad cases, sometimes not even death, but you get very sad. And I had a case about 2 weeks ago where I actually got teary-eyed talking to this elderly family about end-of-life care for their father. You know, they always have their impact. Sometimes what we do is debrief right there in the ED, or you come home and you talk to your spouse, or you'll talk to your colleagues the next day, your talk with residents. And I think debriefing is what we all do.
And when you're in seeing a patient and you really have no idea what's coming there. In some respects, it's like the family doctor, but we can get a little cheat sheet. We get that problem list and we can see what they're there for and the nurses follow up. But you're there and you know it's something fairly acute in their own minds. You don't have a lot of time to spend talking with them, much less than an average family doctor who might have 5, 10, 15 minutes. You might only have a couple minutes to make that rapid assessment. How do you make that emotional connection? Is that important?
That's very important. And I'd say there are several kinds of natural aptitudes that people who go into emergency medicine have. You know, one is an aptitude for variety and changes of pace, but another one is an aptitude to establish rapport fairly quickly. And each individual has a different way of doing this. Some will go over and have a hand touch or put your arm on the shoulder. Many of us will sit down so we're at chair's length with a stretcher. And certainly you always have a lot of direct eye contact with the patient. And you listen. It is interesting because we have done some studies with our residents in the past, and you probably spend less than 4 minutes talking to each patient. But yet in that time interval, you have to be able to inspire confidence in, you know, that you have to inspire that patient has confidence in you. And I think you do it with that kind of visual or tactile stimuli that you give.
And considering the overcrowding in the emergency departments and some of the challenges, even though these places have grown dramatically, it sounds like, over the last many decades, there's still a problem with long lines and people trying to get in. And how do you juggle some of the frustrations that people may have when they get there with trying to care for them as best you can and compassionately as you can?
Well, you know, there are two sides to the coin of long waits in the ED. The first side is the patient side, and the second side of that coin is the physician side. In terms of the patient side, We may apologize. We may say, thank you for waiting so long. We appreciate your patience. Things like that when you begin the encounter. We certainly don't challenge a patient if they're angry about having waited a long time. And we do our best to keep up with the flow. The other side of the coin is the physician emotional response to overcrowding. I get extremely upset and feel so bad personally for patients who are waiting in the waiting room, even for more than an hour. And many times, of course, the wait is up to 4 hours. And of course, that's one of the big preoccupations with emergency medicine now, is how do we handle a growing influx of patients with decreasing or perhaps inadequate hospital resources and still be sane. That for me is one of the most difficult parts of practice, is that I have people in the waiting room. I try to go out there and see them, bring them back, try to start tests early, but there's no good solution.
So what do you think is going to happen with now a third of those who are uninsured in the United States getting insurance, and hopefully within a number of years, increasingly numbers of those uninsured being insured? How will that influence what happens in the emergency room? Because for many of us involved in medicine, we know the emergency room is the place to go. If you can't get care anywhere else, people can't be turned away.
Well, different methods are being looked at to handle more patients with the same resources that we have. And this is being done not only across the United States, but also around the world. We think that using the Massachusetts data as an example, that once any of the improved insurance kicks in, we anticipate seeing 8% more patients in the ED. And we know it's going to take a lot longer to get a good supply of family physicians out in practice to take care of the increased office demands as well. So a lot of things are being talked about, increasing use of mid-level providers like PAs and nurse practitioners, and those all have pluses and minuses to them. Forgetting about putting every patient in a stretcher, but having a lot more people in chairs. Starting medical care right at triage, and some places have put a doctor at triage, so you can start with a quicker examination and get the test going right at triage. And all that because we don't really think we're going to get any more hospital resources to solve the problem. The other thing that's happening in the U.S. is hospital occupancy is at an all-time high. Mm-hmm. When I started at UNC, maybe 70-75% of the beds were filled. Now we're running over 95-98% occupancy. You can't move people into beds in the hospital if you can't get them out of the beds. So we're heading for a gridlock, and it's going to require a system approach. The ED's working closely with the hospitals to solve that problem.
We know you've talked about the history of emergency medicine and some about the current challenges and maybe the next 5 or 10 years. But as we look ahead 50 years, what do you think will be, and this will have to be our last question as we wrap up, but what do you think will be the most exciting thing for the future of emergency medicine?
Well, 50 years is a long time ahead. And,
Make it 25.
Yeah, I should use the same way of thinking I tell everybody, have big ideas. I see emergency medicine working much more closely with all of the specialties in medicine, especially family medicine. We're going to become real tight partners in medical care. Electronic records are going to make things a lot easier. Everybody's going to be able to see what the patient had done before, what we did in the ED, and be able to communicate with the physician.
Well, Dr. Tenelli, even though you may be a second generation, we're going to need to keep you around for the third and fourth generation to capitalize on your wisdom and experience. We want to thank you for being our guest today on Your Health Radio.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Judith Tentinelli, Professor and Emeritus of Emergency Medicine at the UNC School of Healthcare and Medicine, about Life and Death in the Emergency Room. Thank you so much. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like Christy or I to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments or question to yourhealth@unc.edu.
And Adam, we've got some really good questions today about fertility, about some mental health problems in the family.
About pain and numbness in your feet and your hands.
I know, good ones. Well, let's have our executive producer ask us our very first House Call question.
What do we have, Erica?
My husband and I have been married for 4 years and have decided that it's time to start a family. We've been trying for about a year now with no luck. My husband and I are both 28 years old and no medical problems. We've both been checked. I know things take time, but we really do want a baby, and we just don't see the light at the end of the tunnel right now. Are there any natural things we can do to increase fertility, or do you think it's time that we begin looking into IVF?
Well, that's a good question, and lots of questions in there. And
first
of all, congratulations on trying to start a family, and light at the end of the tunnel. Most people who want to start a family will eventually get pregnant. The majority will.
Yeah, and it is an exciting time that both you and your husband are on the same page about it. You know, I think generally after a year of trying unprotected sex, especially assuming you're having a lot of sex, and that's a reasonable time to go in and talk with your doctor about your questions and about your approach. I think some of the questions a doctor might ask are how much sex are you having, and are you having it sort of in that middle time of the month when you're most likely to ovulate?
So 2 weeks after your period is the time when you're most likely going to be fertile, and some people will have you check a basal body temperature to see if your temperature changes during that period of time, because that's when you're ovulating, and that's the time when you're most likely to get pregnant within 5 days of that period of time.
And so there are lots of sort of very low tech with the basal body temperature and monitoring your body to see when you might ovulate. But there also might be worth having some additional testing, including having your husband's sperm tested, because sometimes having a low sperm count can then make it a little more difficult to get pregnant.
And there can be sperm that are adequate numbers even, but they don't function as well, the quality of the sperm. And there may be some medications that one of you are taking that you shouldn't be taking. There may be medications that you could take to help increase your fertility.
I think what we're saying is that there are a lot of, you're asking about natural things. Well, one, have a lot of sex. But the next thing would be that there are a lot of options and ways to think about it without having to jump straight to IVF or in vitro fertility. So do continue to work on this with your husband on the same team and go together and talk with your doctor about it.
Good idea. What's our very next house call, Erica?
Last year, my little sister had a psychotic break during her freshman year at college. Shortly after her break, she was diagnosed as being a paranoid schizophrenic. My parents moved her back home so they could keep an eye on her and make sure that she takes her medications as prescribed. About a month ago, we began noticing that her paranoia is at a heightened state and her behavior seems to be disorganized, almost childlike. I believe she's off her meds, but my parents don't want to come to grips with it. What should I do?
Oh, that's such a difficult situation, and we certainly appreciate you sharing that with us.
And it sounds like you're actually have come to grips with it. And, you know, that's not easy for a parent to come to grips with the fact that their child who is at college and seemingly with one track all of a sudden has a very different track. It's kind of like, well, if they were diagnosed with cancer, that would be a really difficult thing. Well, paranoid schizophrenia is an exceedingly difficult emotional, psychological condition that has physical manifestations. And boy, that's hard too.
I would encourage you to talk to your sister potentially if you're able to speak with her about your concern. Talk to your parents about your concern and potentially involve her psychiatrist to try to see if you can coordinate everybody on the same page and the best way to take care of her. Certainly very complicated and a long journey ahead.
And ultimately, if she is off of her medicines, she will relapse. And it sounds like that could be what's occurring. That could be a crisis. She may need to go to the emergency room, may need to be hospitalized for psychiatric stabilization. All things that you have the best interest of your sister at heart. Good luck. Thank you so much for that really important question. What's our very next house call, Erica?
I've recently been diagnosed with plantar fasciitis, and oh man, does that hurt. I could have never dreamt that I want to cry like a baby by simply standing up. And I can't even get relief at night. I wear a foot brace to keep my feet straight, and that doesn't even give me a great deal of relief. My doctor suggested that the foot brace at night and insoles in my shoes for a while, but I don't know how long I can stand this. Is there a surgery I could have to get rid of this once and for all?
Well, it depends on who you ask. You ask an orthopedic foot surgeon, they'll tell you, yes, there is surgery. Though most orthopedic foot surgeons wouldn't necessarily recommend that as the very first line of treatment. It might be kind of the last lines of treatment.
Well, the first thing I would recommend is that you talk with your doctor about, are we sure we have the right diagnosis? Because you want to make sure that, you know, you're not missing some other thing. But even potentially doing an injection can often give you some relief in addition to the things that you're already doing.
And I think we've mentioned on the show before, there's some really simple exercises one can do in terms of stretching exercises with an elastic band and some
tennis
tape
ball.
To stretch and massage and ice after walking, heat in the morning before you start going, special inserts in your shoes, a whole bunch of things before you get to surgery. But I have had patients that have needed surgery, and it did help them.
So it might be in your future, but we certainly hope that you can get some relief sooner than that and that you don't actually need the surgery. Thank you for your question. Erica, what's our very last house call?
I've recently been experiencing a constant tingling sensation in my right hand. If it was accompanied by another symptom, I would immediately go to my primary care doctor. But since it's only tingling in one hand and there's no pain or numbness, I've let it slide. I'm 48, female, and was given a clean bill of health within the last 6 months. Have I put myself in harm's way for delaying medical attention? What are your thoughts?
Well, you're seeking some advice right now, and at least sharing a concern, which is a great thing, because there may be some other listeners out there that have something similar, and they're wondering, should I see medical attention? What do you think, Christy?
Well, I think I would want to know what kinds of things you do with that hand. So sometimes, either from overuse, if you're doing a lot of typing, or from inflammation in your wrist, potentially something called carpal tunnel syndrome. And we could ask our health sciences librarians to post some information about carpal tunnel syndrome. Sometimes anxiety, sometimes there are a variety of things that could give you a little tingling in your hand, vitamin deficiencies. There are all kinds of things that could do it, none of which would be particularly dangerous by waiting a little bit to seek care. Adam, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think the fact that it's been going on for a while now, though we don't really know how long it is. Do we know how long it is, Christy?
It doesn't say. It just says I've let it slide.
Yeah, I think the fact that you're worried about it makes me worried about it. I think you should come in. You know, you might have to have an EMG, electromyogram, pins and needles sticking into your extremities, which sounds painful.
That sounds terrible.
It kind of is. But, you know, you might need to have that to find out really why and to help understand why. Some blood work, as Christy mentioned. I think you should come in and be seen.
Thank you for your house call questions. We've talked a little bit about fertility and about mental health challenges in the family.
About these pain in the feet that may or may not need injections or surgery, plantar fasciitis, and then tingling in the hand and other symptoms that don't go away probably should be seen.
Thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We do hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health. We want you to share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and our health app.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Judith Tintinelli. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heels station.